Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, a look ahead to 2016, taking in BBC Charter renewal, the EU referendum, and the biggest media stories to come. And joining me as usual are two of the media's best and brightest, BBC News presenter Tim Wilcox and Mihir Bose, writer and columnist at the Evening Standard.
Media Focus.
So, first up, BBC Charter renewal. The Beeb's Royal Charter expires in December, and many are worried about the scale of reforms and cuts. Culture Secretary John Whittingdale is already on record saying the licence fee is worse than the poll tax and unsustainable in the long term. Tim, what do you think the new charter will look like?
Well, it's going to be a difficult year in terms of negotiations. It always is. Of course, the licence fee was not raised. It was kept at its level in 2010. So the BBC is bracing itself for some big changes. And I think, you know, the public are aware of that as well. You mentioned that quotation by John Whittingdale saying that the licence fee was worse than the poll tax. I mean, a lot of commentators are thinking that perhaps he will actually show the dagger, if not wield it. This talk about subscription channels. I think what is clear is that the BBC is going to have to make more efficiency savings. We've already seen, 16-20% cuts in terms of cash expenditure. We've taken on with the over 75s another £750 million worth as well. But there will have to be some big changes. And I think for Tony Hall, it's going to be extremely difficult, because if you look at the cash efficiencies, a lot of people are saying that actually you're going to have to see some channels go as well. You've also got the other problem, of course, about the online presence, the internet presence, the new media presence as well, plus all the things that the BBC has had to take on in the last few years. For example, BBC World Service, BBC Monitoring, also some extra Welsh language programmes as well, which is adding, £340 million, plus those cash efficiencies as well.
Well, Tim, you're quite right to mention that John Whittingdale might or might not wield the dagger. I think it's worth recalling that John Whittingdale was, of course, very close to Mrs. Thatcher. To a certain extent, some in the Conservative Party believe that this is unfinished business, because there was always talk at the height of the Thatcher era that the BBC should be privatised, you know, the idea that we should pay a licence fee. But I think what has happened, and this struck me while I was there at the BBC, having worked for the BBC for many years on and off, is that the media has changed, its relationship, the written media has changed. Before, there was a great deal of affection for the BBC. The online presence of the BBC has meant, and with the decline in newspapers, you know, fewer people reading papers, we were a country where, you know, people bought two or three newspapers. Now, you know, if you go through the London Tube, everybody is reading the Metro, which, with great respect, is not the paper that one would want to read all the time. But anyway, the point is that because of this hostility to the BBC, unless the BBC tackles this whole question, that it is going into the area and making newspapers unprofitable, I think it'll face a lot of hostility and a lot of anger from the media about what happens to the BBC.
Well, that is clear, obviously, isn't it, in the last few years, when you look at some of the media response to anything that the BBC does. And I think you're right, that is something that in terms of online presence, they will have to look at very closely. But it's worth remembering also just the breadth, the reach of the BBC, and the fact that when you look at recent polling on this, 97% of British households have TV anyway. People, yes, are watching iPlayer and things like that. Yes, there's hostility, for example, about the punishments for not paying your licence fee. That doesn't appear, according to the latest rumours, as if that's going to be changed either in terms of prosecutions. But the BBC, though, has that public service presence and that reach, which a lot of people, as you know, defend absolutely in terms of what it can do as a news organisation compared to other news organisations internationally.
Yeah, but that's a great contradiction of the BBC. It's a much-loved organisation, a much-needed organisation. You know, it's one of the great institutions of this country, along with the health service, something this country should be proud of. And yet, at the same time, because of what has happened, because of the internet and online, what has happened to the written media, the BBC suddenly finds itself in a position where anything the BBC says goes against the BBC. And that problem, if you like, this is a legacy with great respect to John Burt and the changes he made. I'm not saying all those changes were wrong, but to a certain extent, time has moved on and the BBC probably hasn't resolved this contradiction of a great organisation, which is still the barb in which it never was. I mean, certain parts of the media were always hostile to the BBC, but now most newspapers have people who say, what's the BBC for?
Yeah, but maybe those aspirations need to be reined in a little. But when it comes, for example, I mean, there's a big
debate about racing chasing, for example. You know, does the BBC need to actually go head-to-head with commercial television or something like that? Now, these are all debates which I presume, because it's, you know, I'm way below the levels of the BBC.
I thought you were going to resolve it. Fortunately,
having to discuss...
You're not DG yet.
All this, well, I never would be. But, I, you know, for example, sport. You know, you were a former sports editor there. You know, there will be... Obviously, times when the BBC cannot compete and will have not to, won't be able to compete and shouldn't even want to compete.
Do you think it's using the knife more than showing it this time? Because, you know, BBC Three is going online. The BBC is actually closing down channels. I'm often hearing that, you know, in this particular licence fee renewal, you know, there's going to be these cuts and this programme might suffer and these people might have fewer staff. But we're actually seeing actual cuts now. You know, BBC Six Music was threatened to close and then didn't, but BBC Three has been threatened to close and has.
Well, going online, as you say, I'm not quite sure what the savings are there, but I think, you know, the BBC, and I can't speak for the BBC, I'm just speaking as an individual on this, even though I've sort of, you know, worked for them as a presenter and I travel for them on news stories. But I think, you know, people understand that things have to change. We need to be leaner. The BBC accepts that as far as I can see. And there is restructuring going on. It takes a long time in the BBC. It's always been described, hasn't it, as this sort of like turning an oil tanker at sea, trying to get any changes through the BBC. But I think the BBC, in a modern world, though, understands that it has to be more competitive. And again, that is one of the rubs, one of the dilemmas, I think, when you've got BBC Worldwide, for example, so you've got commercial arms and you've got licence fee funded arms as well. And that makes it perhaps more of a conundrum than other news organisations elsewhere.
But my experience with the BBC was that the BBC often does not sell itself very well. It does not explain to the public how vast it is, how complex the organisation is. A News at 10 and Today programme, they're the same BBC, but actually two different programmes, and they're great rivals, you know. And OK, with the newspaper...
To be fair, though, I mean, I think that is changing now. You're seeing a lot of people, say, from BBC World Service, for example, now being used by TV bulletins. You're seeing certain sort of international correspondents appearing on all channels now, writing for online, doing radio and doing everything else. So that is the way that the BBC is trying to harness all that talent and stop that internal competition, because obviously having two programmes working for the same organisation competing against each other, it's almost like in newspaper terms, isn't it? If you've got this sort of Mail on Sunday and the Daily Mail competing against each other, but they're all being paid by the same employer.
Well, which, of course, they do, but because it's commercially funded, that's just a matter for them. The problem is because the unique way the BBC is funded, it's in our interest to query these things.
I remember when working for the BBC, used to ring somebody up and they'd say, well, this is the fifth person from the BBC that has rung you, you know. But what I'm saying is...
Well, it still happens now.
Well, but actually the public outside are not told often enough as to how the BBC works and the complexities. That needs to be explained. The BBC has to get on the front foot and not always react as if...
But Mihir, you know as well as I do, you know, when I'm out in the field, for example, and I'm reporting or being sent by a particular channel, I stand there and feed about eight different other outlets as well. You know, so it is relentless because it is such a huge organisation. And if you're going to cut down on deployments, then those people are going to have to work harder. And we, as you know, we often end up doing 20, 22-hour days going all the way through.
But the BBC does have a plethora of outlets. So, for example, you know, when I used to work at Parliament, I've often said this anecdote that I looked at College Green and there'd be the BBC with, you know, eight people there and there'd be Sky with two. But on the other hand, someone once said to me on this podcast, I forget who it is, but they said, yes, but Sky have one channel to feed, whereas the BBC have PM, News Channel, Panorama, and any number of different outlets that they need to provide content for. So you can't just have one person doing the whole thing, because otherwise, why would you have distinctive news programmes?
No, the BBC is a great institution that needs to be preserved and protected and encouraged. I think the problem with the BBC is at the top of the BBC, how do you project that and make sure that you get the best deal possible?
But Mihir, you could argue that, like BBC Three, the cut of that, for example, one of the part of the BBC's remit is to connect with hard-to-reach audiences, and young people are watching less and less television. BBC Three seems to me one of the last things that should be cut. Why aren't we cutting Let's Play Devil's Advocate, Sherlock, and all of these other kind of big-ticket stuff that the commercial industry can do reasonably well? And, you know, I love Sherlock. I want it to carry on being made, but does it have to be on the BBC? Can it be on ITV?
Well, the way it has worked historically is that the BBC has chased ratings. You know, ITV has got... I mean, I remember remember, and I'm old enough to remember, when the cup final was shown both on BBC and ITV. Now, you know, that makes me sound prehistoric, but that was true. That used to happen. Now, all that has changed. For instance, Radio 1. Radio 1 started off to combat Radio Caroline, which was an offshore pirate station. Now, many people would argue, do you actually need an old-fashioned Radio 1? Because young people don't listen to music in the same sense. I think one needs a lot of thinking about where you go. I entirely agree. You need BBC channels to have programmes which nobody else will make.
And the fact is, Paul, if BBC 3 is going online, you know, if you look at the trajectory in terms of demographics, more people, younger people are watching now, sort of online as well. That seems a natural fit. I mean, that seems to be joined up thinking, doesn't it? What were the last stats? I thought 39 out of 50 top digital sites were watched on the mobile, others on desktop. But actually, people spent longer on desktop. But the experience I have of my children in their teens, you know, they are now taking things they want to watch in small grabs on their phone. So BBC Three going online would seem to be a logical, you know, trajectory.
And also, at some stage, perhaps the BBC should consider, I know it can't be done, whether the World Service shouldn't be shown in this country. You know, at the moment, it can't
you mean BBC World?
Yeah, BBC World should be shown
online,
in this country.
You? Well, you can stream it on certain sites.
Yeah, and you know, and all these things have to be looked at in a totality. And I personally think the BBC should be careful that this government, and certainly Whittingdale, would probably want to do something which shows that he's making dramatic changes. And I think that shouldn't be ruled out.
Where do you think the knife will be wielded then? I mean, obviously we've named a number of shows and channels that are moving, but if there is going to be this new super lean BBC, that is going to involve the BBC doing fewer things than it has done in the past.
Yeah, well, I mentioned it. I mean, iSport, you know, I think Chris Patton was said recently that you can forget any bidding from the BBC for major sporting events now. Plus also, you know, the knife has already been, well, not wielded, the knife has already sort of lumped on another great dollop of costs for the BBC on this over 75s, and the license, those licenses now being paid for by the BBC
and the World Service,
exactly, and another £700 million. You know, it's going to be very tough. But I think, Lord Putnam was just recently saying that he would have resigned had he been chair of the BBC Trust, had that been foisted upon him. But he wasn't in post.
Do you think, though, that there's a market to be served for people that don't want adverts compared to the commercial rivals? So, for example, I enjoy Sky News. I like it a lot. But there are a lot of adverts on there. I also know that I can turn on News Channel whenever I like, and it's advert-free.
Well, and people are always using ad blockers, aren't they, now, which is another issue. But
So the license fee as ad blocker. Is that, I never thought of it in those terms.
The best thing is to record the thing and you know, switch off when the ads come.
Doesn't really work on rolling news. But,
no, it doesn't work on rolling news, that's true. But I mean, there had been doubts raised about the News Channel.
Tim, are you safe for now?
Well, I don't actually work for the News. I don't work for
I see you on air all the time.
No, I don't work for the News. I work for BBC World now. So I have moved. But you know, there are mergers going on there, for example. There's a lot of shared airtime between BBC World now and the News Channel as a way of trying to streamline things and to cut costs in terms of studio space. You know, there is an argument to be made, or is being made, that perhaps there should be more of a sort of merger between those two channels as well, since we're both covering often on huge international stories exactly the same story, and guests are just going from one channel to the other, you know, which is costing satellite and
airing up. In a sense, those kind of efficiencies, no one would argue with. I think ultimately it gets down to the point where you're going to have to cut things, and someone in a position of management is going to have to decide that this is going to get cut
that's going to take some very brave decisions. And, you know, which DG wants to go down as the DG who's had to axe well-known, well-loved programmes and or channels? It's a tough one. So, you know, it's lonely at the top, isn't it?
But, I mean, the BBC has to get on the front foot and make the case. I mean, it shouldn't have to make the case, but what is in the present climate, because of what has happened, it needs to make the case of how important the BBC is for this country.
Which it is. And you know, if you look...
But it has to make the case because there are still people out there who would argue that the BBC is not good, or it spends too much money, or look at all the, you know, the frivolity on which it is spending money, without realising that actually to cover a news story, you require to spend a fair bit of money.
What do you think in terms of Whittingdale's comment that the licence fee is a poll tax? I mean, I'm not sure the exact...
Worse than
the poll tax.
But Whittingdale should know about the poll tax because, of course, he was involved with Mrs. Thatcher when the poll tax was introduced. I think, well, that, you see, those words were said some time ago. But if you like, those sentiments are shared by some people within the Conservative Party, some people, you know, if you like, on the right, you know, some readers of the Daily Mail and so on. And I think he would start off with those sentiments and perhaps make a few concessions. Now, I don't see the licence fee disappearing, but the licence fee would be so hemmed in by all sorts of restrictions and additional charges put in that, in effect, the actual working of the licence fee would mean the BBC doing much less than what it is doing now.
And so death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, well, rather than an exact cut and saying no licence fee.
And also, I mean, there's also talk about that sort of the Finnish model, isn't it, which has been debated, where you have a means-tested licence fee where households that have a high income would pay more than others. I mean, I think it's all up for debate. And, you know, we don't know quite what issues are being sort of wrangled over at the moment, apart from the fact that, you know, I think everyone accepts it is going to be even tougher for the BBC than it has been for the last few years.
I mean, what we have to recognise that philosophically, what has changed is that about 10, 15 years ago, one would have said the BBC is like the National Health Service, you know, it's got to be protected. It's no longer treated on a par with the National Health Service. No politician would stand up and say, no, you're not going to get money for the National Health Service. You know, that is just not a winnable proposition. Yet a politician could stand up and say, yes, the BBC needs to change. We need to have a subscription service. We need to have all sorts of things. And that is where, can the BBC come back to a position where it is once again, as it used to be, on the same sort of level as the National Health Service, a country's jewel, which should not be tarnished in any way. And I'm not sure it can come to that.
Well, maybe it's just a jewel which needs to be reset.
So, Mayor, where do you think we'll be a year from now? What do you think will actually happen?
I think we'll still have a licence fee. I don't think the licence fee will be removed, but I think all sorts of additional charges, if you like, will be put on the BBC so that the licence fee, if you like, will not be able to provide BBC with that scope for doing things. BBC will have to make cutbacks, but at the same time, the BBC's ability to go into areas with other broadcasters don't go into, I hope will not be completely lost.
But Tim, final thought on this from you as well. Do you think there could be a potential backlash against the government for this? So, for example, when the closure of certain much-loved BBC brands like Six Music have been floated in a serious way with the public, there's been a huge campaign to save them. And
well, there has, but that's been directed, hasn't it, at within the BBC itself. You know, that was the campaign to keep Six Music going. And of course, you know, there are many valid reasons why supporters would say that nothing needs to be changed at all. But in the financial reality whereby money has to be saved, it seems pretty inevitable to me that, you know, other channels or, you know, hefty departments will have to be lost. And that is just the reality of broadcasting in the 21st century.
What the BBC should do, if the restrictions are too great, they should say we're going to not have Archers anymore. That'll get Middle England going.
So next up, dividing lines on Europe. With the EU referendum expected to take place this year, The Express and Sunday Express have already said that we should leave. The Mail, The Sun, The Telegraph and The Times are also expected to support Brexit. Meher, do you think the papers will play much of a role in this debate, or do you think the debate will take place on social media?
I think the papers will play a big role for the simple reason that I think the vote will be decided not by the young people in this country, most of whom are probably pro-Europeans or at least would vote to stay in. The vote will be decided by the people who generally vote, the older generation, many of whom are very much doubtful about Europe, much more than they were when we voted to remain in the common market in 1975.
So quite apart from the media coverage, which we'll talk about in a second, you actually think that the UK will vote no?
I would say that the UK is more likely to vote no rather than yes, just by a small percentage, because I think a lot of people feel that they were hoodwinked about Europe, that they went into a common market, they suddenly found themselves into a European Union, they just kept out of a single currency, and they don't like, you know, this country doesn't feel European. The only time this country branded itself as European was when it had an empire. Then it went around the world to places like India and described itself as European. Apart from that, historically, it has never seen itself as European. And I think there's a lot of anti-European feeling. You know, Brussels does everything wrong. You know, Brussels is a bureaucracy. Brussels spends too much money, interferes, you know. And, you know, we can't use the word pound anymore. We've got to use kilograms and things like that. You know, all that sort of thing. You know, there's a lot of popular mythology about that, which has developed. And I personally think, now, with the young people, with the generation of my daughters and so on, you know, they would probably vote to stay in because they have a different outlook. But I think the 40-plus who are going to decide the vote will probably vote no. And they are the ones who are going to be reading the papers, talking about it. And if you look, I think, I wouldn't be able to say offhand, but historically, most of the papers in 1975 were pro-European. You know, now, I would think, as you mentioned the papers, most of them, a few papers who would say yes, but most of them would say no.
Do you think social media will have any influence? Because we had Lyndon Crosby on the podcast a few months ago, and one of the things he said, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he said kind of Twitter was an echo chamber of lefty, youthful type people who were, you know, were all kind of enthusiastic about remaining within Europe, but that Twitter, the Twittersphere didn't reflect what people in the real world were thinking about. And there's, you know, you could call them shy Tories, you could call them real people, whatever.
I would agree with him to the extent. I wouldn't say that's the real world. The real world is also Twitter. But it's the younger folks who, you know, if you like, who are much more on Twitter than people who are above 40 or so. They're less inclined to be on Twitter. They're more inclined to either watch the news on television, on the established media, on newspapers and so on. And I think they are less inclined to be affected by what the social media blows up into a big storm. And I think in that sense, yes.
I mean, Tim, this is the ultimate in anecdotal evidence, but I was talking with friends over the last year or so, and I've been asking them, you know, do you ever change your mind as a result of any media influence, social media or traditional media? And all of my friends and family and people I know have said, actually, the minute something was announced, I knew how I was going to vote, and I've never changed my mind.
I know people who say that as well, but I think what is really interesting now is that, you know, this is probably going to happen this year. We've got the debate now being engaged in by both sides. And I think people now want to know and have very clear information. And what is interesting is that the sort of previous year's sort of explanation of what Europe costs and whatever, when you actually put it under the spotlight, those figures change in terms of benefits, costs of migrants and things as well. And I just wonder, after that mass exodus last year, what, 1 million people plus coming into Europe, whether politically this has been something that David Cameron can actually use and bring about the reforms and changes that he says he wants within Europe, which politically he can dress as an argument to say, look, he's achieved what he wants, to actually convince people not to get involved with the Brexit. And just on the question itself, you know, the Electoral Commission recommending should the UK remain a member of the EU or leave the EU, it isn't quite as that original bill was putting through, which just needed a yes or no. And I think it is, you know, it is a very complicated issue, but drill down, get the facts. I think if the press take a certain view, then social media can actually sort of push a lot of this other information out there as well, and people can make up their minds. So I think, the polls are them level pegging at the moment. So I think it's very, very close.
But Tim, I think what's going to happen in this debate is that the no voters will present this as the people who are against you, the big corporations who are for staying in Europe, you know, the parties who don't understand your sentiments, the people coming in. I mean, this question of migration. I mean, I've seen the migration debate in this country change enormously when, you know, in the 60s it was so-called coloured migration, you know, people coming from the
Jamaica,
old empire and so on. Now, of course, migration, you know, nobody in this country is any longer a racist. It's very hard to find anybody who admits to being a racist. You know, now the migration question is, of course, from Eastern Europe and things like that. And what will be seen, what will be presented is two facts. Getting out of Europe will mean saving money because we pay far too much and get too little benefit. And B, we will have control over our borders. Now, whether that works or not is a different matter.
Yeah, but the converse of that argument, as you know, is that actually by being in the EU, it's actually benefiting each household by £3,000 a year. I mean, you know,
you take your stat and you run with whatever you want. Those arguments will resonate much more. You know, this whole business of what has happened as a result of the Syrian crisis and the whole migration situation, it will resonate a lot. That's my feeling. And I don't think the social media in that sense will not help. It's the written word, if you like, in the mainstream press, how they analyse it and how they see it will have a much greater impact.
But Mihir, in a sense, you could say, right, the Daily Express and the Sunday Express have come out to leave. Now, I imagine that most Daily and Sunday Express readers already are fairly sceptical about Europe. So will they have any agency? Will there be any change? Because I think the fact that you're reading the Daily Express suggests that you're already fairly anti-EU, and therefore if they come out against it, it's not going to turn anyone new to that cause, surely.
No, but I think if you have the Mail, the Times, the Sunday Times, the Telegraph, all of them against. And remember, we have a whole political issue here. What is David Cameron going to come back with? Is he going to say we stay in? How many of his cabinet members might campaign against? You know, I mean, there is this whole political situation that we can't ignore, which is David Cameron went in with this referendum idea in order to make sure that the Conservatives could finally put Europe behind them. It might turn out that, you know, at the same time as we vote on whether to stay in or not in Europe, there's a whole political question of what happens to the Conservative Party and Cameron. So, you know, there's a whole complex issue
there. But it's
not
just toxic for the Conservatives, is it? I mean, it's toxic for Labour as well.
It's more toxic. You know, it was back in 1975, if you look, Harold Wilson had this referendum in order to keep Labour united, and he pulled it off. Whatever changes, minor changes he made, he pulled it off. With Cameron, it's a much more toxic thing, because at the moment, Labour is looking like a party that doesn't exist. You know, and the way it is, yes, it could be toxic all over the national scene. But what I'm saying is that I think most of the papers will take a stance. And apart, perhaps, from The Guardian and The Observer and so on, I can see most of the mainstream papers saying, on balance, we should leave.
Tim, do you think there's an argument that David Cameron never expected to win the election and therefore never expected to be held to the promise to hold a referendum? Because clearly, if there was going to be a coalition, if the polls were correct, all bets were off. Anything could have been renegotiated in terms of a second-term coalition government.
Well, that's certainly something that is discussed widely, that, the polls confounded everyone. But I just think on the Europe issue itself, you know, if he can actually come back with serious arguments about serious change, for example, on benefits already, you know, and I have no political allegiance anywhere, but on benefits, it's already being discussed among other EU members that this needs to be addressed by countries formerly who were very much in favour of having, benefits for all and indeed the Schengen Agreement. So the whole idea of Schengen is coming up for renegotiation or discussion, certainly, along with benefits as well. Now, if he can turn that politically into an argument, say, look, I've gone in and I forced these changes because of what has happened over the last 12 months, then perhaps he will get that through. And just one other thing, you know, I think in terms of referenda, the status quo ante is always the thing that, you know, it's very difficult to get people to make a fundamental change. And you might just get to the day, you know, who knows, but where people just think, well, do you know what? Yeah, we always have these rows and everything else. But to take this leap now and potentially be cut off from certain trading blocks and the costs of us having to trade with, you know, the European Union, like Norway, for example, what that would cost, you know, people might just say, do you know what? We might just better to stay in. And I think there is always that sense of perhaps potential inertia there.
No, but I think, Tim, if you're right, and Cameron comes back with a package which says we have got what we've always wanted, which is part of the common market, not part of a political union, which is really the great divide. And, you know, Cameron, let's not forget, Cameron's great heroine, Mrs. Thatcher, after all, signed up for the EU and all that happened. We all know what happened to the Conservative Party. If he can do that convincingly, then fine. I think this country will vote to stay. And you see, what is it very interesting is that even as the country may move towards staying out, you know, moving out, leaving Europe, socially and culturally, we are probably closer to Europe than we've ever been. Mm. I mean, my time of covering sport, when I first started covering sport, the idea that Real Madrid versus Barcelona would be a live football match shown on British television would have been laughed at. And the football correspondents going to the Bernabeu, of course, nice time, nice to have a trip to Madrid, you know, would be considered, the sports editor would have said, are you mad, you know? Go to Clacton and report, you know, Yeovil Town playing there. But, you know, culturally, we've become closer to Europe. And yet politically...
Well, it's largely because there are so many international players now.
Yeah,
but
the whole thing has changed in that sense. And yet politically, there is still, I think, a great deal, much more than there was in 1975. And we've been defrauded. You know, this British sense of being morally, you know, put in the wrong, you know, that will play a big part. Because I think the ante will say, you've been defrauded by the politicians. You've been defrauded by you. And that will be, I fear, I'm not in that camp, but I fear that could be a winning argument.
Gentlemen, can I ask you about the challenges of covering this issue as journalists? Because you've got an incredibly divisive and emotive issue. There are two camps that there's a lot of animosity and bitterness between them already. It's a bit like Shades of the kind of Scottish referendum. You know, it's a technical discussion in terms of the facts to be discussed, but it's also a heart issue. I declare an interest. I'm going to vote to remain in when the referendum is. And I don't really care about the arguments to leave because my heart says that we should stay in. So in a sense, I'm not someone that can be reasoned with. So how do you do you deal with that as journalists, that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't? Well, there's technical things you could be held upon and you're going to get attacked from either side.
Well, it's Tim who'll be under the spotlight, you know, when he's standing there, because the moment he says any word, you know, people will analyse it and say, you know, he's biased, like they did with Nick Robinson, if you remember. And the troubles
But it's like any big international story, isn't it? Like, so, you know, trying to sort of give an impartial view or report on anything in the Middle East, for example. You know, one is attacked by both sides pretty heavily.
And does that show you're being fairly impartial then, if the, you know, the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority both criticise you? Is that the kind of litmus test?
Well, I suppose it is, but it's not a very comfortable place to be sometimes. Yeah,
except I think what will be interesting is if you look at how Europe is treating it. In Europe, you know, there are elements within Europe now who think that probably if Britain wants to leave, it's just as well Britain should leave.
Yeah, but I think Paul is right. You know, I think, you know, as with any, in terms of covering any story, you know, one drills down to the facts, one tries to find all the facts, you know, and have an impartial body doing that in terms of the academic research which goes into it, because all these things can be subchanged and presented in a different way, as we know. But I think, you know, journalistically, that's what you do, isn't it, Mihir? On any story you
cover,
you work out what the truth is, and then you think all the facts as you understand them to be, and then you use those as a way to actually develop the debate.
But this will be like a political, you know, political election, you know, where we will get sound bites from both camps and things like that, you know, and already that has started, and it'll progress, and I think it'll be much more intense than any political campaign we've had in recent years.
Mihir, do you feel freer as a columnist, as someone who can write with an argument, as it were, whereas Tim's on air on BBC World, he has to present the facts in a kind of dispassionate manner. He can't then go on to say, I personally believe X, Y and Z.
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you work for the BBC, you have to be very, very careful. I mean, you know, it got to the stage as sports editor. I mean, I grew up supporting Tottenham Hotspur. I couldn't say I was a Tottenham Hotspur supporter because, you know, people said, oh, you can't say that, you know. It's that sort of level, if you like. I mean, I know that's trivial compared to the European Union, but for the BBC journalists, having worked for the BBC, it's a very, very difficult position to be in, because almost any fact can be misinterpreted as being pro or anti, any statement you make in this sort of debate. And yes, in the media, outside the BBC, you can actually express an opinion, back it up with facts, and people can respect you for that. In the BBC, it's much more difficult to do that.
But the point is, Mihir, you know, as a journalist on air, you know, one is engaged in an intellectual debate, and one is putting the arguments from opposing sides to the other side as well. As long as you make clear that that is something which you are putting from the side of the other party, that's okay. But occasionally, people misinterpret that as well and think, well, hang on, you just said such and such. So, you know, it is this qualification, but it is like a debate. It is there to try and seek out the truth and try and sort of either pick holes or you make clear that the argument that one side is having, you know, is coherent.
Look at what happened with calling it the Islamic State. You know, now the BBC says so-called Islamic State. If you remember all the fuss that was created.
One of the things, actually, when I was a print journalist before as well, you know, it was always drilled into you cannot say so-called.
Yeah.
You know,
this is just, and yet the BBC says that now. Well, because people said the moment the BBC says it's Islamic State, you're making it a state. But actually, that's the name they use. Mm.
Well, you know, now I just say Islamic State, otherwise known as ISIL or Daesh. You know.
It's a mouthful, isn't it?
But that is, you know, that is a BBC thing. Yeah. Well, where is that? You're right. As a print journalist, it's so-called. What does so-called mean? Yeah. Either there's a name or it's not a name. Yeah.
Is it difficult, Tim, last question on this, when you're on air? Because clearly you have extra activities. You know, if you want to write about this, you've got to be very careful if you're going to say your opinion. In America, for example.
I wouldn't ever give my opinion on anything. You know, even on a podcast like yours, Paul.
So you're mindful of your responsibility as a BBC presenter at all times.
I think one has to be Otherwise, well, of course, you know, I would never discuss what my political affiliations were if indeed I had any. Yeah.
You mean you've never voted?
do you think the TV is moving more to the American model? Because, you know, they have the opposite over in America, where it's the newspapers are actually quite balanced, whereas the TV channels are completely unhinged. Here, the papers are absolutely, you know, crazy, you know, with their opinion, and the television is very balanced. But on the other hand, we've seen this increased prevalence on News Channel and on Sky of paper reviews. You know, there's like 3 hours of paper reviews, and a lot of it is getting journalists to kind of just talk about their opinion in a chatty and in a more kind of conversational manner. Do you think it's we're going to get wall-to-wall pay-per-views during this thing as a way to kind of circumvent the Broadcasting Act?
Well, Mihir, you could answer that because you do more pay-per-views than anyone.
Well, I think that is happening. I think one of the things I have seen on
is that
on,
a compliment or an insult?
No, it probably is an insult.
It's a compliment. I mean,
I'll take it as a compliment, Tim. One of the things is very interesting. You say the written media, news stories in the written media now are more opinionated than they ever used to be, rather than just reporting the facts, because they feel, you know, people already know it in the social media, what has happened and so on. And I think one will see on this debate, trying to explore opinions, but trying to explore them maybe through paper review, maybe through other channels, so they can get their opinions across. Because otherwise, particularly the BBC, would be accused of taking a particular stance, you know, being anti or pro. And of course, for most of the anti, the BBC is always classified as pro-European. That is the general image of the BBC. I'm not saying that's fair, but that is the general image. You know, the BBC is establishment. The establishment is pro-European. And the BBC starts off by being seen as pro-European even before the debate has begun.
And finally, some of the biggest media stories in 2015 were the unexpected ones. Government misuse of investigatory powers, curtailing of the Freedom of Information Act, trouble at FIFA, Channel 4's potential privatisation and the Sun's paywall crumbling. Tim, Mihir, what do you think the biggest media issues of this year will be? Tim, we'll start with you, good self.
Well, obviously, in terms of international stories, Syria, Iraq, Islamic State, how we report Islamic State, how we do that dispassionately without allowing, for example, their very slick media operation. I mean, if you look at the latest videos from Islamic State, or certainly the ones in the last few months, you know, they have 4 or 5 camera shoots. You know, that is more than an international broadcaster does.
And Fox News are showing the whole video online.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to drive clicks.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the problem as well. So I think, you know, in terms of how media companies respond to the propaganda being put out by them. And actually, interesting, I'm just reading a book about Tamerlane at the moment, the 14th century guy who took over from Genghis Khan. And Islamic State has this reputation, of course, for horrific barbarity. But when you compare, you know, the executions of things they did with what actually happened in Tamerlane State, where he actually had 68,000 heads on ramparts outside cities, which he took over, it is the propaganda machine of Islamic State which is so dangerous, I think. And that is something which is going to be a real issue for international broadcasters.
And is it an issue for broadcasters in terms of how much to show? Because the very fact that they put their victims in orange jumpsuits reminiscent of Guantanamo Bay inmates and so on and so forth, they're deliberately creating a telegenic
Of course, but point of death, of course, is something the BBC will not ever show. But again, you know, you pixelate faces, you don't show total horror, but you need to also convey, of course, the barbarism of what they are doing.
I read an article about mass shootings in America that one of the motivating factors of these young people that go into schools and shoot as many people as they can is the notoriety, the media spectacle that it will create. And a growing body of psychiatrists and psychologists are saying, actually, there's a duty on the media not to name the perpetrator of the violence and to not glorify it, because actually there could be a correlative element there, that media opportunity, if they know they're going to be denied it, will actually, you know, stop some of these shootings happening.
The point is, I agree with Tim, you can't show these scenes, but of course they are shown on the internet and so on. I mean, because we now live in this duality of the media, you know, it's no longer just watching the 9 o'clock news or the news at 10 and what have you. But you can't get away. I mean, how do you convey the barbarity of ISIL and at the same time not actually show the barbarity? I mean, for instance, Saddam Hussein's death was never shown, yet those pictures were freely available. Some people
on YouTube
showed it,
or whatever.
I remember the morning it happened, though, because these pictures were coming in and you actually saw him looking confused just as he approached the noose.
Yeah.
And then it was cut.
But you see, you have a huge problem that there are still people, and you meet them, who refuse to believe that 9/11 didn't happen the way it did, or, you know, ISIL isn't the way it is. You know, they all see it, some of them see it as an American conspiracy and things like that. I mean, there are all sorts of theories out there. How does the media cope with that? How does the media try and convince the world that the events that happened did actually happen? You know, it's a very delicate argument. But you mentioned one of the events. I mean, apart from what Tim mentioned, I think the big event that will be there this year will obviously be the American presidential election. And if you have Trump as a candidate for the Republicans. I mean, that will be an absolutely amazing story. And, if, you know, Hillary Clinton winning would be the first woman president of America. So I think that will be a huge story. And the impact, I mean, after all, America is the greatest power on earth. Whoever becomes the American president has a huge influence on world politics. So that will be a very big, and a bigger story than, and particularly if it's Trump likely to become one, or his impact on the election, that'll be a bigger story. I mean, American elections are important.
He could lead. Ted Cruz, for example, coming through.
Yeah, and the impact of that, the next president, the next most powerful man or woman, you know, what the impact would be, I think that would be a huge story. And I think we'll get more coverage of that than we've had before.
And also, Paul, just interesting, you mentioned American mass shootings, but, you know, gun control, something that Obama has talked a lot about in recent years, and yet really achieved very little because of Congress being hostile and the Republican Party as well. You know, if he took out some sort of executive order to push that through...
I think that's the recent update. Yep, he's going to try and circumvent Congress, isn't he?
Exactly, but then you've got Republican candidates saying that they would overrule that as soon as they, if they were to win.
But, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I remember 8 years ago when Obama was elected, how the whole world felt a certain sense of elation, and now I'm afraid, and I felt that now Obama looks more and more like a college lecturer, you know, who seems to have, you know, got to the wrong podium. But I think that whole business about what America does, I mean, in world politics, its impact and so on. And I think we're also going to get a lot more stories from Eastern Europe because, you know, the way Russia has behaved and so on. So I think there will be new areas of conflict, if you like, which will become quite a big issue.
And just reporting on, say, for example, Russia, you know, it's seen very much as this monolithic state now, and Ukraine and areas like that, extremely difficult and increasingly difficult for any journalist to actually get anything out of certain areas because of the restrictions placed on you by the authorities and also the risk to you if you are seen to be there working as an independent journalist.
Tim, what's the challenge as a broadcaster when you're on air, where you've got two competing worldviews, and how do you present them equally when they're not necessarily equal? So, for example, you know, there are people who believe that the moon landings never took place. I mean, clearly there's evidence that we did, so you wouldn't present someone who said yes, they did, equally with someone who didn't. But, and like creationists, you know, that's been a challenge in terms of, you know, clearly the scientific consensus with evolution. How does it work on issues like climate change, for example, where, you know, 97% of scientific opinion is of the view that... man-made carbon emissions cause climate change, but there is a small but significant minority opinion that challenge that. How do you present that? Because clearly just putting one person up with an ante wouldn't be a fair representation of the debate.
No, but I think also, I mean, the way I think, you know, as I said before, you ground everything on the facts which are agreed on by, say, the majority. And then if you've got somebody who is, you know, arguing vociferously about climate change, but then you perhaps would put some of the exaggerated claims that have either been exaggerated or not to them as well. So I think it's testing out the arguments of both sides and also just exposing perhaps when either side has gone too far or has made too hyperbolic a claim about what they believe. But as I say, I mean, it all comes down to the facts. It all comes down to impartiality, one hopes, in terms of one's own performance and the fact that you can play devil's advocate by putting the opposing arguments to each other. But as you say, I mean, if it came to the moon landings, of course, that never happened.
No, but I think what has made it much more difficult is that to get a balanced view is because with the growth in social media, what in the old days would be an argument in the pub, you know, after a few drinks saying, oh, the moon landing never took place, would now be out there, you know, on Twitter and might be considered a fact because, you know, I think that is where reporting has changed completely, where suddenly something is said which is absolute rubbish, because it goes up on the internet, it's accepted.
So, it's so difficult, Mitch. I mean, November the 13th, Friday the 13th, I was on air that night with reports coming in, nothing on the wires, nothing on the agencies would usually trust, say, you know, AP or APTN or whatever, or Reuters, nothing about those shootings at all. The first hour, we were relying on tweets. And, you know, you have to be so careful about this, as you say. So, you know, there are reports coming in. But that was the way that story unfolded. And that's the first time, as far as I can remember, that social media has driven the entire breaking of a story. you know, 20 minutes, half an hour before any of the established agencies.
Well, I mentioned this a couple of podcasts ago, but I remember one Sunday afternoon when Cilla Black died. The news broke on Twitter. Twitter was awash with, "Oh, Cilla's died." And then about 20 minutes in, that Twitter was awash once again with, "Cilla's died, but why aren't the BBC covering it?" And mm-hmm. we're all there looking at Twitter on our phones, also looking at news channel, thinking, when are they actually going to say it? You know, and it is a difficult balance, isn't it, for news channel? Because you don't want to then say that she's died if she actually hasn't.
Well, of course you don't. No.
But I think the problem with Twitter is, I say problem, is that there are people who have millions of followers. So in a way, they are in a sense a news channel of their own. You know, if they put something out, it gets out to a coverage which is enormous. And I think, to a certain extent, established media still haven't worked out. I mean, there are young journalists now growing up, and I feel sorry for them, who actually just report on what is on Twitter.
Piers Morgan a couple of days ago. He tweeted that Tony Hart had died and expressed his condolences. But Tony Hart died about 8 or 9 years ago, and he was taken in by a hoax, wasn't he? So, so is that how it works in the newsroom then? You start to see a lot of tweets about something, then clearly that pricks your ears up and thinks, right, we must look into this.
Yeah, I was in the studio that particular night, you know, and it is tricky, and you have to caveat, and you have to, you know, you have to say that, look, these are the reports coming in, or this is posted on social media. But then as soon as you can actually get, I mean, the good thing about social media is that you sometimes can get hold of those people who've been tweeting about this or putting something on Facebook. And then if you can actually speak to them and put them on air, then that is the way of corroborating what they're saying. But it's a very difficult area.
It's citizen journalism, isn't it?
Which I remember in the Arab Spring, we relied on the whole time, in Libya and in Egypt and places like that. I mean, you were given images from people there on the front
line. Which you wouldn't have had in the past.
No, which you wouldn't have had in the past, and which we then used. Yeah. You know, in Ashdabia, we had people with phones
but
showing
things. It also destroys the balance of trying to get a correct story. You know, the idea is when you do something on a broadcast channel or a news, it is the story, whereas what you're presenting may be a partial evidence, you know, partial fact. You know, it's a very, very... as journalists, you're supposed to do the first draft of history, but this is not even the first draft. It's the first doodle of history, you know, which may turn out to be absolute rubbish. And that makes broadcasting and the written media much more difficult than it used to be.
Has social media changed your kind of on-air experience, Tim, in a different way? So, for example, one of the things I always am mindful of now is when anyone noteworthy in the public media kind of dies, the anchor is basically reading out tweets because, you know, all of them, you know, it's the Prime Minister said this, his colleague said that, but it is effectively a kind of eulogy in 140 characters, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, for us, especially, you know, working on a rolling channel like BBC World now, that is the quickest way of actually reporting on something like that, and as you know it's graphicized and you can see what these tweets are. It has changed significantly. I mean, I've been a journalist now for what, 34-35 years,
and when you've aged well, Tim,
but I remember my first working for Fleet Street News Agency, and I used to write. I used to write copy for the Evening Standard in triplicate and then take one of the copies down to Fleet Street and hand in the copy to the desk there.
I'd bring all that back. I'd go back to parchment and quill if I could.
Smoking and proper typewriters. Ashtray clean 3 times a day.
Yes, of course, there's a lot more drinking than now. But the point is that what has changed? What has changed? How journalists report news. Very often now, reporters will not be at the event. They'll be seeing something on their screen.
Live pictures.
You know, I mean, when I at Wimbledon this year, I was really amazed that most of the journalists who had, of course, access to the courts were actually sitting in the press room just looking it on television because they were instantly having to tap out stories.
And Hawkeye and things as well. You can see that.
Yeah. And also because they're doing it, whereas in the old days, the days that Tim is talking about, you wrote a story and that, you know, if it was for the written media, it didn't come out till the next day. Even if it was broadcast, it was at a particular time. Mm. Now, because it's instant every minute, the nature of the medium, if you like, influences how the story is done.
And the potential for getting it wrong increases, which is why you need to have even greater safeguards in place. Why that Cilla Black, you know, didn't happen. Although
I think the people
I imagine that would have been excruciating. Yeah. For a lot of the journalists,
the old BBC thing was that to do a story, you had to have two sources. And in the old days, the BBC journalist would leak a story to Reuters to prove that, you know, the story was valid.
Well, gentlemen, nostalgia isn't what it used to be, but we're out of metaphorical tips. I think we'll have to leave it there. How do people follow your work, Mihir, on online? Are you on Twitter?
Yes, I am on Twitter, yes.
And well, you're on Twitter because I follow you, actually. But
I don't have a million followers, I'm afraid.
How many followers do you have?
Just under 12.
12 followers?
No, just under 12,000.
Yes. I think I'll cut the mischief for the next podcast. So what is your Twitter handle? How can people follow
it's
you on Twitter?
It's just at Mihir Bose.
Tim?
I have a Twitter account, but it's a BBC Twitter account. I tend not to use it unless I'm out on the road because, one is not allowed to express one's own views. I'm sounding terribly sort of priggish on this, but so I tend to use it just for an update on what I'm reporting on to let people know, if I'm doing an interview or something on that.
So given that you've had all of those caveats to say how terrible your Twitter account is, could you tell us what it is so that we can follow you anyway?
It's called at BBC Tim Wilcox. That's what it's called, yeah.
And for those that want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard. You can also go to the website mediafocus.org.uk and leave your email address in the box and receive a shiny update once a fortnight letting you know when the new podcast is out. But that's it. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'm Paul Blanchard. The associate producer was Jordan Greenway. The social media producer was Hannah Thompson. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.